get you, Barbara.
Stop it.
How will we make it?
Maybe we should. Why don't we just...
Ah! What did you see, Clary? What did you see?
I like to remember things my own way.
Remember me.
Reasonably unhinged.
Yes, hello and welcome back to another time with the Reasonably Unhinged crew. A very small crew this time because it's only me, Heiner.
And it's me, Noor.
And together we did watch Waiting for Guffman.
Mm-hmm.
A unique American comedy film from the 90s and the directorial debut of Christopher Guest, a non-American. He's actually a British guy and his background is weird. He's actually one of the lords in the House of Lords in England. He's like comes from a royal family.
Yeah.
Very weird because in this movie he actually also plays a character and that's not a royal character at all. But maybe first to get us acquainted with what's going on with that film, a quick synopsis. Waiting for Guffman is about a small town, and in this small town we have many quirky characters, and most quirky of them all is Corky, a guy who came from New York to this small town and became a drama teacher at the school and wants to give us some New York sensibility in a small town and wants to put on a play about the anniversary, the 150-year anniversary of the town. And everyone rallies around this play and we have a lot of hijinks ensuing in this weird setting with these many odd characters. But first of all, Noor, how did you see the film? What were your first impressions of it?
It was funny, light, and easy to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was really easy to watch, but it also, I was surprised with how kind of non-threatening and very sort of unexpectedly nice all of these characters are. Because mm-hmm. usually I feel like these days, we probably have to say it's the mockumentary style, which at this point has become sort of the biggest comedy vehicle of all time. The mm-hmm. Office, Parks and Recreation, these modern comedies all utilize this style of having our characters speak directly to the camera and giving us this appeal of the intimacy of a documentary, but in a comedy sense. And this was one of the movies that actually helped sort of bring this form into a popular arena. But what goes with that is that often due to this intimacy, you have a lot of revelations about the deep darkness behind these comedic characters. But Waiting for Guffman doesn't really go for that. All of these characters, they don't have that much hiding under their surface. They're yes. really all about what they present themselves as. And I really found that refreshing because, yeah, I wasn't used to it in this sort of setting. I don't know if you have any point of reference for the mockumentary comedy genre. Have you been an avid The Office watcher back in the day or something like this?
No. I guess this is my first time.
Really? The first mockumentary comedy you've ever watched?
Yeah.
That's incredible to me, somehow.
Maybe I can't remember, but...
Yeah.
I can't remember something similar I have watched.
Yeah, where they constantly are cutting to them in a different room and talking directly to the camera about what's going on, stuff like that.
Yeah, it's similar to Arab's Got Talent.
To what?
There is a show, I think it's an international show, which is American Got Talent, and we have Arab Got Talent.
Yeah. I see. So the typical reality show format, that's very close to it as well. Yeah. It's true. It's interesting to think like what came first and what sort of informed the other.
Yeah.
Because it is a very powerful tool to get right into the meat of things, to get to the core of a character's personality. Mm-hmm. And we have so many fun characters. I really, really love the characters in this movie. I didn't expect there to be such a rich tapestry of different guys and girls. It's incredible. Maybe we'll start off with the characters. Who stood out to you, maybe? Do you have like a favorite?
The director, Corky, I guess.
Yeah. He's also the director of the film itself and the author.
He's similar to someone I know in real life.
Really? Yeah, he has a...
You also think he's a great director and what his shows are really the same.
Wow. So you have a real life Corky in your life. That's fantastic.
Yeah. And he's calling his shows surrealism, which is sometimes
accurate. A little bit.
I can't say it. He can spend 6 months with his funny actors like this, and there is no idea.
They are all still at square one. That's funny.
Yeah. And this is what I can see. At least Corky have the same. Also, there is no idea about his show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just throwing things at the wall.
And then I don't know how he will take this show to Broadway, but it's okay.
Yeah. Maybe if we're talking about Corky this much, I have a little clip we can listen to about what he is all about, having said that he has come from New York and his Broadway experience. We'll listen to that.
I had been living in New York and working there as an actor and director and choreographer for 25 years or so, and I really felt I needed a change. I imagined in my fantasy, I suppose, that when I came here, I would have a completely different life. Perhaps a construction worker or one of those guys that works on those high wire things that with a hard hat, you know, that sweeping sort of hat and with the chaps. But that didn't really work out. I began to realize, I guess, that the theater was still in my blood, and what I had to do was make use of that. So I offered my services to the high school here, and they accepted, and I began to teach drama. And within about 6 months, I had formed the Blaine Community Players. My first show was Barefoot in the Park, which was an absolute smash. But my production on the stage of Backdraft was what really got them excited. This whole idea of in-your-face theater really affected them. The conceptualization, the whole abstraction, the obtuseness of this production to me was what was interesting. I wanted the audience to feel the heat from the fire, the fear, because people don't like fire poked in their noses. You know, when you get a cinder from barbecue right on the end of your nose and you kind of make that little face, that's not a good thing. I wanted to have the sense memory of that. So during the show, I had someone burn newspapers and send it through the vents in the theater. Well, they freaked out. Of course, the fire marshal came over and they shut us down for a couple of days. I'm feeling good about where we stand now with our cast. I think that the elements, as Dr. Watson said to Sherlock, are coming together, sir. I'm very excited about Ron and Sheila, the old standbys, the workhorses. I call them the lunts of Blaine.
Yes, and those two are another big part of the movie. But also from this clip, you probably already got the idea that this movie is not as tightly scripted as normal movies. Mm. It also applies this new form of dialogue, which now is also very popular in television. For example, Curb Your Enthusiasm, the very popular show, employs it to just have outlines of what the movie is all about, not have actually a tightly written script, but more this is going to happen, then this is going to happen, then this is going to happen. And then the dialogue is mostly improvised by these very seasoned comedic actors who are just very happy to be able to probably spend hours and hours to just push out any idea they have in the moment. Mm-hmm. And from that comes this kind of gold of him imagining him himself to be a construction worker, but mostly focusing on the attire and how he would look doing it and how he would enjoy having this kind of look authentically portrayed.
I
really loved it. But he is the outsider in town. This town, it has some specificity to it. We immediately get a sort of intro of it with the council in the town sort of deciding for this centennial. There we have another really funny moment where they sort of imagine putting rifled shooters, like snipers, on top of the buildings, because last year some people were vandalizing stuff and they should really start getting behind that. And at the same time, they all seem really nice, kind of like I was really pleasantly surprised, because the usual formula for this kind of movie is to create many warm and interesting characters, but also many sort of really awful people to bounce off of them, to create conflict in a very direct and easy way. But the movie doesn't do this. It doesn't take the easy answers to create conflict. The conflict is mostly coming from the eponymous Guffman, because Corky does at some point promise the cast that there will be this mysterious, almost mystical, fantastic talent agent and producer from Broadway, Mr. Guffman, who's going to show up at the show and take them to Broadway right away. And this was the moment where I was like, okay, this is how they'll turn the energy. This is how they make this depressing. But they don't. I don't want to take too much away from the way the movie flows. But again, there's not the easy answer, but there's a more nuanced take on failure, maybe.
Yeah.
But I'm losing you. I see. keep me in the loop. Where are your thoughts?
I just want to comment on the moments that he was casting the.
Actors. Yes, 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 yes. We have to get to the casting scene, because there we also get some people who don't show up anymore in the movie, but have this one scene moment that is so funny. My favorite, maybe you want to allude to it too, this old guy who recites a line from Raging Bull, the Martin Scorsese boxer movie.
I just want to say that I can feel that most of them, that they have midlife crisis.
Yes,
I don't know.
Yes, this is the driving force of most of these performances, is that they are stuck in this small town and they feel like they haven't really realized their potential to some point. And this is like their big moment to shine.
Yeah.
Most of all, obviously, Eugene Levy, probably most popular to most people as the father from the American Pie movies. But he's also a complete comedy legend. He's been a founding member of SCTV, the first real sketch show on television that made big waves to subvert some expectations. And then, of course, now he's most known to people for this Canadian show. What's it called? It's like Schmucks or something. Schitt's Creek. Schitt's Creek, it's called. About like rich people coming to a small town and basically buying it up, but also trying to accommodate themselves to this everyday life. But anyway, not the big Eugene Levy show. Eugene Levy here is a dentist. And he is sort of the unexpected star of the show. Corky is like, oh, who would have thought? The dentist in town, and he's got so much moxie. Like, I was expecting Corky to be also much more cynical because of his experiences from New York, that he would, like, in these interstitials where he's talking directly to the camera, be like, nah, these guys don't really do that all that much. But no, he's really, like, on board, and he's really enthusiastic about these people trying.
Yeah, you can feel he's part of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially, I can say, maybe I'm just moving very quickly when he asked him to remove his glasses.
Yes.
It was really stupid.
Yeah, Dr. Pearl, Eugene Levy's dentist character, has big, big glasses on. Yeah. And at some point, Corky goes like, nah, this maybe doesn't play well on screen. But he has this little funny caveat where he goes like, yeah, we're going through time in this play. Mm-hmm. So for the early stages, it just doesn't make historical accuracy sense to have glasses, so you need to get rid of them. You can put them back on when we are in modern times, but now it just doesn't make sense for the production. But he has such a bad eyesight that once he takes them off, he also, it's probably just a skill that Eugene Levy has that they employ in this movie, but he has this really crazy move with his pupils where one of them goes completely
inward.
You
are doing the same by the way. No.
Wow, so I didn't know I had this skill as well. Well, to look at your nose is the secret to it. But he does it differently because one eye is still wandering and the other is completely locked inside.
If you practice, you can do it.
You are so encouraging. Thank you very much. But yeah, Dr. Pearl, he is kind of the star of the show, although Corky somehow manages to get everyone to think they are the star of the show, which is probably the secret to a good director, especially for amateurs.
Yeah.
To handle all the egos. Arguably the biggest ego in these rooms is Fred Willard, who really shows the biggest darkness. He's the husband of the husband and wife duo. Both of them are iconic actors. Catherine O'Hara is probably known to most people as the mother in Home Alone, Kevin mm-hmm. Allein zu Hause, mm-hmm. as it's known in Germany. She does an incredible job here, but I also wished she had a better role because she does have to play the sort of second fiddle to his extremely, to her extremely, sort of, I don't know how to describe him actually, ideally. A kind of insecure yet very boisterous man that she's married in Fred Willard.
They what look did you good make couple. Of them?
Really?
Yeah. Traditional
Didn't
one.
You catch all the little like sly asides?
Traditional couple, so.
Yeah, okay. Dysfunctionally traditional, I would say.
Maybe they are good. Even if it's a love story, they are getting bored, so. They are very old.
Yeah.
As a married couple, yeah.
They have stuck it out for a long time, but I think you can see that this was probably the worst choice that he could have made. I think they enable each other in very weird ways.
Yeah.
And especially Fred Willard, he always has to have the last word and he's very controlling of his wife. We only get this in like small little doses because he tries to hide it when mm-hmm. they are in public, but sometimes it's almost jarring because all these characters are very warm and there's not really a lot of darkness under the surface. But with the Fred Willard character, I did feel like their home life is probably very dysfunctional and very problematic because he does always seem to try to control his wife in weird, weird ways.
She seems, I'm not sure because I was not able to catch it. She seems, she was not happy with this controlling or no?
No. I mean, she seemed to have resigned herself to it at this point.
Well,
she seems to have given up to some degree to try to fight back against her husband.
Okay.
But they are dynamic when they are together on the stage or auditioning together. They are mm-hmm. extremely like hot for the stage, for the limelight, and you can see that this is sort of probably what got them together in the first place, that they try to enable their delusions of grandeur together. But yeah, we are at this point in the final stages of the pre-production. And this is also something that sort of surprised me, the way that the movie structures itself forward. It's not the typical grand finale in the production being put on and all the stuff going wrong in the production. But mm-hmm. we are in the middle of the movie also already starting the production, and there's a lot happening after it. I really enjoyed the way this movie flows from scene to scene.
Mm-hmm.
We are really, really thrown into a crazy new setting once the movie gets started. But before that, do you have any more scenes that stood out to you?
I want to comment on the scene when Gorky went and asked them for $100,000. And
yes, this is one of the great scenes. Yes.
Yeah. And when his actors get crazy and went to his home.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the first part is fantastic because he just shows up at this council again and says like, yeah, we need more money. I'm sorry to ask you for this. And then they ask how much, and he says $100,000. Mm-hmm. It's a complete like laughing stock. Like our whole budget for the year is $16,000 or something, like for $15,000, and you're asking for $100,000. And I expected it to be this moment where then they start to sort of negotiate with him or something. But no, he is just going little child mode and says like, well, then it's just not happening. Goodbye. And then he just goes home and hides himself away in his apartment, which is also so weird. This weird stairs going up to this door, which is like on the second floor of a building. Yeah. It's so weird. Oh. And then, the camaraderie that's developed between the actors that he's cast already is that they feel like a group of friends who have to pick up their friend, and they all show up at his doorstep and go like, we can't do it without you. Oh, and this reminds me, we haven't even talked about the antagonist of the movie, because there is a very unique presence in the movie that is not as comedic as the others. Mm-hmm. Bob Balaban, he's called. He is the conductor of the orchestra that they have for some reason. We'll get to the production. It's much bigger than you would have expected from the start. But Bob Balaban is sort of the music teacher and long-standing institution of the arts in this small town. And he hates that Corky is stealing his sort of cultural limelight in this environment, and has to play second fiddle, the music producer or not the head of the production, which he had usually been for these kinds of productions. But he has a very different kind of vibe to all the other characters. He's not the goofy guy. He's a very stern, small man. You've probably seen him in some Wes Anderson films, or really in any film. He's always in the background somewhere. Mm-hmm. And he's always this stern little man who is concerned about numbers or about the future or about any kind of thing that could go wrong.
Yeah.
And in this case, he is the perfect antagonist for Corky, because Corky never really realizes that there's friction. He doesn't give a shit about this guy.
Yeah.
And he is basically completely consumed by him taking it away from him. And in this moment that you've mentioned, where he sort of takes himself out of the show, I was thinking the movie was going to go very hard into this conflict direction and give Bob Balaban the bad guy or the not as fun guy, the hat, the creator, director hat back, and it's going to be them struggling to get out of this not as fulfilling creative role that they have. But no, they immediately say, we're not doing it with Bob Balaban. Fuck this guy. We're going directly to Corky's home and saying, we need you back. We won't do it without you. And he has to remain on the sidelines. He doesn't really get any sort of moment where he gets to shine. He always has to play second fiddle.
Yeah. But for me, if I have to choose, I can choose him, not Corky, because he's more serious. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, all of these people, it's beautiful that they found each other, but you have to be insane like them to have fun in this environment. I would also probably go insane the first audition day.
Yeah.
And they are successful, of course. Corky is addicted to love, addicted to affection, and addicted to hearing that he's the greatest. And when all of those things come together, when he's home, he can't say no. He has to go back to the production. And it's really jarring how quickly from this moment we jump to the production actually being performed. Mm-hmm. I was expecting a lot of like moments of failure in rehearsals and stuff like that, but we don't get any of that. We are immediately thrown into the production and get like, I don't know, like 30 minutes of it or something.
Mm-hmm.
There's many songs, there's many moments, there's obviously the
songs,
empty.
I need to comment about the one
yes.
of the songs. I heard the first one here in Germany. I thought it's German. But it's international.
What?
The one with directions.
The one with directions.
Yeah.
In the musical.
Yeah, in the musical show. You know when they were carrying the chairs?
Ah, yeah. The stools.
Yeah.
The stool song.
Exactly, yeah.
I've prepared it actually. Maybe we'll listen to it and then we'll discuss it. There's even an intro from this weird intro guy who hadn't shown up in the casting process. Mm-hmm. And then he's just there talking about beans in the intro. But anyway, now we'll listen to the stool song, because we have to mention, obviously, the little town they're living in is the stool capital of America. Every stool produced there. And they have this, yeah, this reverence for stools because they are a big part of the industry. But yeah. Enough talking. Let's listen to it.
Rich and poor alike had to have a Blaine stool in their home. The little town never knew what hit it. Footstool factories sprouted up like toadstools. Everyone had a good job. Everyone was making a good wage. Blaine was on the map.
Fantastic performance. We were talking a lot about Corky's dancing also in while this clip was playing. There's one scene that's just incredible, which is just Christopher Guest, the actor who plays Corky,
mm-hmm.
Improvising dancing. And he has this crazy outfit on and he does these weird moves, like stuff is on the ground and he's trying to dance around it. It's just insane. And it's just, yeah, like 30 seconds of complete, yeah, improvisational comedy.
To be honest, I'm not sure, but I heard the German version of this song. I'm not sure, but in that show with that director I'm telling you about.
Yeah.
He was, the words of that song, maybe they are a little bit different, but the same, you know, the same tone, same melody, which is they explain the directions in German, left, right, up, down.
Ah, okay.
But yeah,
I'm not familiar with it. Maybe if I'd heard it, I would go like immediately.
That's why when I listen to it, I felt, oh, this is German.
I think it's just a very popular melody in musical theater to go like.
Maybe they are using it for kids.
Yeah, it's probably like a very popular choice for children. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Yeah.
And yeah, you mentioned we also have to discuss it, and you're right, it is a big part of the film, but I feel like the way it handles it is it's never really a impediment to his character or a typecast. But yeah, the Corky, they do make a lot of jokes about his sexuality or his sexual identity to a point, because he has like a Judy Tenuta t-shirt, which is a very famous stand-up comedian who has a big standing in the LGBT community. Mm-hmm. And he also has a fake wife called Bonnie, yeah, who always is sort of mentioned but never shows up, obviously. And he also has a very effeminate persona, which they do play up, which does sort of situate the movie in the 90s. And there is a lot of like problematic things that you could have done with this, but I feel like the movie is very successful in circumventing these traps that arise from trying to make a believable homosexual character. And I was kind of, yeah,
they introducing him as a stereotype gay, which is something I'm against it, because yeah, they are not like this.
Yeah.
Yeah, as his personality is more feminine than, yeah. Yeah, as you mentioned, I think mentioning that he has a wife give him an excuse why he's buying woman clothes.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But as I've mentioned, I feel like in this movie the creative people do succeed in giving him a much more nuanced persona, mm-hmm, as the movie goes on.
Yeah.
He still is very much a crazy person, a person who goes all in on what he loves and has his idiosyncrasies and, mm-hmm, is kind of an oddball, but has a lot of warmth, a lot of capability. I also was sort of expecting a rug pull at some point from this movie to go like, no, this is just a guy who is overestimating his own talents and isn't really able to put on a show, and it's all going to fall apart before the actual curtain call. But no, this is not the case. He is actually a very capable theatrical director, and the show that we see is surprisingly, yeah, incredibly well put together. There's a lot of bells and whistles, a lot of great production values. Mm-hmm. The performances are much better than you would have thought from the beginning. We also haven't mentioned the youngest cast member, Parker Posey, who is sort of another icon of the comedy world. But she doesn't really get that many laughs in this movie. She is much more dark as a character, in that her outlook is sort of, I'll keep working at Dairy Queen. I don't know if you connected to this character, or was Parker Posey's character an interesting one for you, or was she sort of a weak point of the movie?
I can't remember it, so I think
she is the young lady who works at Dairy Queen. She is the youngest cast member, and we do get some interviews of her. Arguably, the funniest moment is when she is cooking on the grill just a single chicken wing, just this very small piece of chicken wing, and smoking a cigarette, and not even bitterly, but just matter-of-factly stating that she's not that concerned about her future because she can always go back to Dairy Queen, mm-hmm, which is a fast food milkshake and burger joint in America.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like this is the darkest the movie gets, because she is a very cheery person on the outside, but then in these interstitials, she has like gives us a glimpse at the darkness that her personal life seems to have, because we do later find out that her dad's in prison and just recently got out of jail when we have like a time jump to the future.
Yeah.
So she is really has a bad lot. it feels like a jarring contrast to these middle-aged people who just want some excitement in their very cushy lives.
Yeah, I can't. There is nothing to do with them.
No, there's no real conflict there. They'll just keep living
out
their lives.
But you can see him when he was trying to even convince that young man who was working in the garage.
Yeah.
Yeah, so both of them, I think they are...
That's true. We haven't talked about Mr. Savage. Yeah. What was his first name? Robert Savage?
I can't Fred remember.
Some crazy, like, I'm the hot guy name. And Corky very transparently cast him because he is attracted to him.
Yeah.
And he, of course, dramatically drops out of the production just before it gets started. But it's the perfect opportunity for Corky to say, hey, I know all the lines. Let me be the star. So, yeah, this was another really clever choice I thought the movie made. Because if we were to have experienced this guy as the star of the production, he probably would have been disappointing and not that interesting of a presence as Corky was.
But yeah, but I think those two young men and women, they have extra spices for that show because... With all those old men, looks really. I don't know.
You don't know.
But maybe one day we'll be the same. But for now, I don't like it.
I see. Yeah, we'll see each other in 20 years, and then you'll.
I don't think I will live that long.
Oh, wow! Noah, out of nowhere with the extremely dark comment.
No,
you don't think you'll live for 20 years from now.
Actually, look. For me, I think living till 40 is more than enough. After 40, you become sick, you need people, so...
40?
Which is more than enough.
I mean, I get it if you were to have said like 60, but no. 40, come on, at 40 you...
There are extra 20 years
like
that I will do.
Back pain and stuff, but you can still walk around and be a functioning human, come on.
If you stay single, it's okay till 40, but if you have kids, you can live till 60.
I see. So it's a mandatory thing. So you
No.
You allow people to live till 60.
Not allow people, but this is my idea.
I see. Well, it does seem to be
I'm
a
not
concrete
God to
proposal.
Take their souls. So. No, but till 40, it's good.
Yeah. Is it? Yeah. I don't know. I feel like a lot of people work towards this... The sweet spot where they have.
Imagine in some countries you can retire at 40.
Anymore. Yeah. Is it?
I was in Oman, you can retire at 40 and you'll get 70% of your salary, which is amazing.
Wow.
And most of them, they get loans and have their own business. So you can sit after 40, they are living your life.
That sounds great, actually.
But in Germany, you can't do this.
No. I mean, if you're rich, you can retire whenever you want.
How to become rich?
Nah, I don't know. That's definitely the wrong radio station you're listening to if you're looking for that. Anyway.
I need to work in the stock market.
Oh, no, you shouldn't. I feel like that's going to be its own problem in just a couple of months.
If I want me to live more than 40, okay, I can try.
Okay, I guess I'll try living past 40.
But believe me, what you will do after 40?
I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing
now. What are your plans?
I don't know what I'm doing now.
For me, sometimes when I'm sitting alone, okay, nothing. But I have planned. So after 40, I don't think I will do anything. So, okay. But let's see.
I don't think so. I think like at 40, a lot of people have this big shift in mindset and they
every 10 years according to psychologists every 10 to 11 let's say maximum 12 years you have changed.
Yeah,
that's why most of the relationships
it's a roll of the dice
down after 10
could
years,
be yeah. Awful at 40 could be great. Who knows?
I don't know. When I speak to this to my mom, she's saying this is insane because she gave birth to my youngest brother at 44.
What? That's too damn. Yeah, that's another chapter then. 44 and
but
newborn.
But believe me, motherhood at the age of 44 is not easy.
Nah.
We are the one who raised him, not she. Yeah.
What did she do?
Now, he's the youngest. He's the favorite of all
of
us.
He's
studying in
Erfurt.
He's
the baby.
He's studying in Erfurt.
Ah, he's studying in Erfurt. Mm. Yes.
But what I can say, you can... I can't, you can't, me, I can. All of us, we believe that we can depend on him psychologically, to be honest, because he's very stable.
That's good. Very nice.
He's the youngest. Yeah. There's a big gap between
There's
me and him.
There's some privilege with that. Yeah, that's true.
He learns from our mistakes.
Yeah.
At that moment, I'm the oldest. I didn't learn anything from my parents.
I don't know if they learn from mistakes. I feel like they just get a leg up because they don't experience Who? The youngest.
They learn. If there is a gap for you and your brother, you are back to back, so.
Yeah, that's true.
He learns because, you know, he learns not because we are telling him you should learn. He observes what we are doing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, we still have some of Waiting for Guffman to get to. And why don't we listen to another part of the big production, which takes us to another part of the lore of this weird town, which is that they had an alien abduction, which just took the whole town. Just the whole town was taken by aliens, and that's just part of our collective history. We also get David Cross, the comedian.
I can say in the 90s there were a lot of movies about aliens.
Yes.
That's why, yeah, it's trendy. I love them.
I love alien movies, but I also love movies that just allude to it. I don't know if you're familiar with Encounters.
Could you believe at the age of when I'm 40 there is aliens? So, yeah.
What the fuck? What the are you talking about? Why at age of 40 would aliens show
Maybe
up?
Because they keep saying they will invade us. So.
They keep saying it? What are you listening to? What radio
I'm not
channels
listening to
are
anything.
Taking
There are many, many stupid things.
That's true. But
the religious people, they believe in that each one has its own religion, but they believe that someone will come out of nowhere and survive and save the humanity. I don't know how. Maybe he's alien. Muslim, they have someone,
like
they call it some, I don't know. And the Christian people, they believe this also, that Christ, Jesus Christ, will come back to from.
Yes, but not and from another planet.
I don't know. Where is he? Where is
maybe,
he?
Maybe, yeah, maybe.
Somewhere, maybe in Mars. That's why they are not able to reach Mars.
Speaking of Mars, let's listen to the tune Nothing Ever Happens on Mars from the production in Waiting for Guffman.
Yeah.
Where are we?
How did we get here? Is this a dream?
Look! What is it?
I don't know. It looks like one of them new feed storage bins.
That ain't no feed storage bin.
How did it get here?
It must have flew.
But it don't have any wings.
Then I guess it just dropped from somewhere up there.
Citizens of Blaine, do not be alarmed. We will not harm you. We come in peace from a planet far, far away. A place we call Mars.
I've heard of Mars.
Where's that?
Stand back, and your queries will be answered.
Oh. Look out!
What do you want from us?
Good question, Earthling. It seemed like it was time for a change. Time to take a trip to see the exciting places in the galaxy. For you see, nothing ever happens on Mars. No sports or entertainment or swinging bars. You stand the ground, you stand some more. On a planet named for a Roman god of war. Nothing ever happens on Mars. No supersonic airplanes, no sporty cars. The sun comes up, the sun goes down. You can't go to the country, you can't go to town. Boring, 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 boring.
Yes. Arguably the most grating of the musical performances, but also deeply comedic, at least to me. How did you
this
take
show
it in?
Really, really goes for KG kids, which is will be perfect.
For
KG kids, kindergarten kids.
KG kids. I have never heard this sort of putting it KG Kids.
This is an acronym for when you are working as a teacher, a KG Kids Kindergarten.
You talk all acronyms. You go like the AG at the 05 and
only the KG Kindergarten. It's everywhere. But in some schools, they call the classes by animals. That's why when they move to primary, they behave like animals. Yeah. Want to say this? Remember in my last school, when they are in primary, they will call them 11-1 lions, 11-1 zebra, and sometimes you have donkeys. That's why when they move to primary, they are teenagers. They behave like what the
I was
according
raindrop.
To the animal they were living in his house.
I was a raindrop and a hedgehog.
What?
In kindergarten, we also had this terminology for
animals?
Our groups. Yeah.
I don't know why they call them. In my KG, no, it was normal.
Yeah.
No animals.
It was just numbers or
I can't remember
letters.
Because my mom was me in the school.
I see.
She was a teacher. I can't remember. Yeah, but there was no animals. No.
No.
Even with my youngest brother, because I can. No, it was just level 1 A, B, like this. Yeah,
like
no
school.
Animals.
Just like school.
But even his colleagues, they behave like animals.
Of course. I think they have to, right? It's like a, almost like a internal like thing telling them to go fucking insane.
No, this is nature. No, this is nature. But the problem is parents sometimes they don't want them. They don't want to confess that they are growing up. This is their way to.
And they want them to be quiet and behaved at home. And if they
go, it's not good to be quiet.
Of course not. They're children.
Parents,
they should go insane.
No, parents. They
That's
want
what they
them.
Do best.
Parents everywhere. They just want to be happy. I mean, they
you
want
lost
someone
steam
to
at the
blame.
End of that sentence.
Yeah, they want someone to blame, and they will blame the teachers.
Yeah. No, that's the easiest thing to do. Yeah. I probably would do that as a parent as well.
Oh my God, you are a very good father, yeah. So it's a good decision not to give birth to babies.
Well, it's not looking like it in the near future. But
maybe at the 45, like.
Yeah. When I'm thinking like, should I die or should I get a child? That's a great binary to have, right?
But it's said we are going the show to a different place. But being a parent these days is not an easy job.
No.
I'm a parent to anyone, but it's not an easy job.
Sure.
Yeah.
Empathy for all parents.
They are not happy with this. They don't want empathy.
They don't.
They want someone to collect their kids.
That's true. That's very true.
Yeah. Especially for immigrants, which is a new environment.
Someone you can trust who can take care of your children.
I mean, for you as German, I mean, anyone who's, for me as a Syrian, if I'm in Syria, I know how things are going on. But if you are in a new environment.
Mm-hmm. How do you even start?
Everything new for you and for your kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes he comes with ideas. This is what I can see, that it's not fitting with the parents. Even my ideas doesn't fit with my parents.
Yeah.
All the time. I never discuss anything with them.
And then there's this fun thing where the stuff you do, the children are probably going to try to do the opposite because they try to set
I'm
themselves apart.
I'm doing the opposite.
Yeah, see? So it's not
You're
that easy.
You're doing the opposite?
Yeah, very much so.
I'm the opposite, especially with my mom. I'm doing everything the opposite of what she wants.
Yeah, I think that's probably a very universal thing. I mean, there are some children who somehow manage to emulate the life of their parents, but I don't know how that works.
But some kids are very traditional. It's okay. They feel that if it's, let's say, the family is very stable, they can't imitate their parents' behavior.
you're so gracious and
if they are
able to let people live
their
life.
If their parents are successful, they imitate success.
Yeah.
Successful and not only financially in all ways. But if you feel that your parents in all the fields of life,
How do you quantify success?
If let's say
I'm not okay with that.
If the kids keep listening, that we are talking about the movie.
Yeah. See? That's what I'm saying.
Okay, so Guffman, I would just mention this for 2 minutes.
Okay.
Success is there is no, for me, there is no definition for success. But if you are happy with what you are doing, which means the environment is positive, and you can, your kids will be happy if you are positive. I want to say 100%. Yeah. But success, I don't know in Germany, but success in my country is different. You should study either medicine, dentistry, or IT. You are successful. Other than this,
no law.
No, there is no value for law in Syria.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Because anyone can go to law. There is they ask them for very low marks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because of corruption, by the way.
Yeah.
So there is no value for law because there is no value for laws. There is no rule. That's why. But in other parts, in the I remember when I studied English literature, which is something I was not planning to study. But, oh my God, I don't know how they... That's why I ran away and traveled. Because people keep talking literature and nothing to do with literature. Okay, I don't know what they did later on with their medicine.
Hmm.
One of my friends, she's still till now.
Studying for
something she doesn't like, but her mother wants her to be a doctor. She at that moment she wants to study not medicine, dentistry, which is also medicine.
Yeah, but the fake one, the one you get a lot of money, but only get to make people's life miserable.
Exactly, if you are happy with what you are studying, it's okay.
Yeah,
just do what you want to do. Yeah. This is what I mean. This is my definition of success and happiness. Do what you makes you feel happy, not what makes your parents and society.
I mean, that's, yeah. Okay.
There is less pressure here in Germany about this.
Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, in a general sense, you can still get awful parents who put a lot.
And you can imagine the people who study medicine, they think that not only the elite, they think that they are aliens. They think themselves they are aliens who will rule like the country. And when someone say he's a doctor, oh my God, you as a female, you should be, surprised. He's a doctor.
Yeah, I'm surprised if people are doctors. I don't get it.
I mean, you are surprised in a positive way.
If anyone's a doctor, it doesn't make sense to me. Like, here in Germany, there's so much stuff nothing. You need to know.
Not only like this. I mean, they get surprised. It means they raise their ego.
Yeah, of course.
They think that, okay, if he's a doctor, all woman needs me. Because of your title and you get money, not because of your personality.
Yeah.
They are not aware of this.
They are going to be rich, safe. So
not all of them.
If you got the real degree, if you got the whole rigmarole until the end, you get the certification to be a doctor.
But this will take you 20 years.
Yes, but believe after me, that, you know.
If you will open a shop, you will get more money in 20 years.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
If it's a matter of money, if you were studying this because you like it, it's okay.
Yeah. Anyway, we only got
a
little bit left, but we are still waiting for Guffman, and the seat is empty while the performance takes place, and everyone's almost down on the ground from this because they really put all of their eggs in one basket. They really wanted to make this big performance for the Broadway guy, for Mr. Guffman.
Yes, this show didn't go to Broadway, as I mentioned. This can works for KG kids. It's similar to what the students want to do. Yeah, but it was funny.
Yeah.
Maybe they didn't do this when they were young, so.
And the big reveal then in the middle is that, yeah, we have some guy sitting down on the chair that's been reserved for Guffman all this time. And yeah, he looks very much like he could be a Guffman type. He seems like a powerful man. He has the big suit and he's an old guy who, yeah, just looks like he's an influential guy.
Yeah, he was clapping and sometimes no.
Yeah, he seemed also critical of it, yes. And then finally, when the play is over and Corky enthusiastically with his spinning hat introduces himself to the guy in the chair and takes him backstage to the actors, it is then quickly revealed that no, he's not the Guffman. He's just some guy who took up this empty seat. And Guffman instead is stuck in New York because all the planes are not able to take off because of a storm. And yeah, that's sort of the big reveal. But at the same time, there is a lot of like sighing and sadness about this reveal. But at the same time, that it can't really take away from the performance and the great job and the success that they've had with the whole of town who is in this little sporting hall where they do this performance. But then afterwards, we do get the beautiful, typical comedy thing of flashing us into the future to all of these characters and where they are. I'm not actually sure, a couple years later, 1 year later or something like that. Do you recall what the time jump at the end of the movie is?
What I like about the movie, that they have confidence, although they are doing very bad. Sometimes that should make you successful, that yeah. The confidence, yeah.
Yeah, but the jump at the end, we get a sort of clip show of all our characters and where they are now. Mm-hmm. Dr. Pearl has moved to Florida, the old people's home of America, and is doing little performances for the elderly as almost like a vaudeville Jewish performer. It's like a rich tradition from the 60s. There is a thing called the Borscht Belt, which was this part of America where these sort of performers would go around performing very typical jokes. Like everyone knew the jokes already and it was about the performance. Here's something that people would look down on today, the kind of performer who doesn't really do original material and just plays
imitating
the hits.
Okay.
Yeah, imitating. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which fits very well with Eugene Levy's character, Dr. Pearl, who just... It seems he has been infected by this play. Mm-hmm. Before that, he was living a very calm, happy, but also probably very boring life as a dentist with his wife. And then in this show, Corky basically, yeah, just gets him his first dose of attention and fame and sort of attention, and he's completely addicted to it. He can't go back to his dentistry life. He has to be a star now. And
so his
kind of stardom is going to Miami to an old people's home and performing for 18 elderly ladies. But he does seem happy, which is another one of those things. Like it has a sort of edge to it, a sort of realism and a sort of sadness that runs under it. But the joy these people feel is authentic, and it's not played that under his surface is all this bitterness about it. He's just genuinely excited to do this thing most people would be ashamed about, which is beautiful. And the Albertsons, the couple, Catherine O'Hara and Fred Willard, they are extras in Hollywood, which also makes all the sense in the world that they would desperately try to make a run at it, but obviously not be able to do really anything and, do the thing that just anyone can do and pays very, very little money to be an extra in a movie, just stand in the background and not have any talking roles in it. Meanwhile, Corky has returned to New York, and his final scene is the funniest thing in the movie to me. I could have watched another 20 of his memorabilia from movies things, and this was also a thing that probably no one else would enjoy as much as someone who's watched like 1,000 movies, because he had like lunchboxes of remains of the day or like Das Boot reinterpretation. It's it's just so funny. I really love this last scene. Yes. Did you take anything from it?
No,
it's fine. I think it's very, very, very much only for the movie fans, but I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But that's pretty much it We only got 30 seconds left. Do you have some final words for us, Noor?
As I mentioned before, what I like about the movie that the characters, they are doing nothing with value, but they have confidence, which is something I really liked.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
That's perfectly sums up what I also liked about the movie. They are shining examples for us when we get older.
Yeah. If I lived more than 40.
All right. With that, we leave you.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.